Hello, welcome to One True Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Today, we have an interesting interview from the Tovia Singer Show on Israeli National Radio. Rabbi Singer interviews Professor James Tabor about his new book, Restoring Abrahamic Faith. This book takes off where James' last book, The Jesus Dynasty, left off. The Jesus Dynasty is featured on my webpage and on Amazon.com. It's also available on Audacity.com. Restoring Abrahamic Faith seeks to reveal how you, whether a Jew or Gentile, can have a vibrant, eternal relationship with the one true Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. James' website and book, which I think is affordably priced, is available to everyone and can be found at genesis2000.org. Now, let's go straight to the interview.
Singer here, Israel National Radio, truth nowhere else, Professor James Tabor, UNC, religion, the history, the true restoring the Abrahamic faith. Joining us now live right here on Israel National Radio, Channel 7, coming to you around the world. Ah, yes, the Pope, the Pontiff, the Vicar, coming to the Holy Land in front of my house. Literally, figuratively, he's coming next week. And joining me right now is a man who I admire deeply. He's the chair of the Department of Religious Studies at UNC in Charlotte. He's been there since 1989. He's helped, I'm not going to go through all the positions he's held at Notre Dame and so on and so forth, but the key is this. He's a historian, a world-class historian, and his specialty is ancient Judaism and early Christianity. But he has done the unimaginable, combined his historical work with this unimaginable, this extensive historical, this archaeological field experience in the Holy Land, and he's one of the principal investigators of the controversial Jesus tomb in Talpiot, which is a place that the Pope might want to get his hands on. But I'll tell you one place that the Pope really wants, and that's Mount Zion, right outside of the Old City. My guest is Professor James Tabor. Professor, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Toby. It's great to be with you.
Hey, it's great to have you on.
Yeah, I've looked forward to this for a long time. We've kind of talked about it off and on and missed each other, so it's good to connect.
But, you know, Hashem runs the show, as we know. The Lord runs the show, and the timing couldn't be more perfect, because after our Sabbath and next week, the head of the largest religion in the world, the Roman Catholic Church, is coming to the land of Israel, and he also is demanding that the state of Israel, it's outrageous, hand over at least five places, including Mount Zion, which is right, essentially, one of the little mountains we have here in Jerusalem. Let's just take a step back here, because we're talking about the leader of the Roman Catholic Church. What is the historical perspective? You got a new book out. It's called Restoring Abrahamic Faith. Give us the historical perspective on the current claims of the Roman Catholic Church over these holy sites.
Well, he's claiming most of the sites are in the Galilee, Capernaum and Tagatha and so forth. But in Jerusalem, it's Gethsemane, the Garden of Gethsemane, and not entire Mount Zion, but up on Mount Zion, you know, the Tomb of David, okay? But above the Tomb of David, it's the most interesting spot on the planet, because you have Jews down below at the Tomb of David, and right above them, separated by a crusader floor, is every Christian tourist who ever visits Israel, and they're visiting what's called the Upper Room, or the place of the Last Supper. Now, this is a crusader site. And it's very ironic, because Catholics and Protestants disagree, like, on where Jesus died. So you've got the Church Holy Sepulchre, and you've got Gordon's Calvary, you know, the so-called Garden Tomb. But as far as this Last Supper site, every Christian tourist goes to this site. Now, that room, it's just a room, it's called a cenacle, which means supper in Latin, is claimed by the Vatican, and what he's interested in is really that the land around it. Now, if you go up there tomorrow, and I'm sure you've been up there many times, you'll see there are yeshivas all around this site that have opened up, because this was not part of the pre-67. In pre-67, before the Six-Day War, this was still part of Israel, and so part of Jerusalem. So Jews have been praying and going up to David's tomb, and not just since 67, like with the Western Wall. So what he wants to do is say that the territory around it would be forbidden for any kind of Jewish development.
Wow.
They already have essentially sort of control over it. I mean, it's like, it's not a church, but it's a shrine. The problem with it is twofold. First, that the yeshivas are right in the courtyard of the place. So are they going to get moved out?
Right.
And all around Mount Zion, this is one of the holiest sites in Judaism, the Tomb of David. And a lot of scholars will scoff and say, well, David, you know, was buried in the city of David down below, and this is not an authentic site. But Josephus, the first century historian, does in fact put the Tomb of David up there. But either way, it's a question of, I think, jurisdiction and annexation. That's the sort of thing that he's dealing with. You mentioned, I taught at Notre Dame. I mean, I am not a Catholic. I would call myself, from a Jewish point of view, a Ben Noach, a God-fearer. I'm not Jewish, but I believe in the God of Israel, the Torah, and the destiny of the Israeli people. But from my standpoint, essentially, all these sites should be under Israeli jurisdiction. I'll give you a perfect example of why. I was just in Israel in November, and I met with the Greek patriarch to talk about excavating some land up on Mount Zion, not here, but elsewhere. Do you remember that there was a scuffle in mid-November in the Church Holy Sepulchre? This is like seven or eight Christian groups fist fighting, knock the archbishop that I had met with down, bloodied his nose. These are other Christians fighting Christians. And guess who came in and restored order?
Listen to this. Go ahead.
The Israeli police.
That's right.
They wanted the Israelis to come in. The Israelis are the only fair brokers of the holy sites in Jerusalem. In fact, they're too fair because they bend over backwards to allow all the religions to have free access. And in doing that, it's typical of Judaism. Let's be so gracious to the non-Jewish world that they'll love us.
Right.
And what happens then is you give them the Temple Mount, and then Jews are hardly even allowed up there. So the thing about the Mount Zion is, I don't care if Christians want to visit the place of the Last Supper. I mean, that's their tradition. They can do that. But absolutely, the area around it should remain under Israeli control. And God forbid there's a riot there someday over something. Who do you want to restore order? And,
yeah,
you know, do we want Vatican police in Jerusalem?
Oh, God.
Because you know how many groups control the Church Holy Sepulchre? I think it's seven different groups.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Armenians, Egyptian Coptics, Roman Catholics, Greek Orthodox. They can't even agree on opening the door in the morning. You know, the key has to be passed around according to certain traditions. So, frankly, having the Israeli sovereignty over Jerusalem has brought more harmony than ever existed in the past,
so
even with these crazy diverse groups.
Well, I just want to add this point. If you're just tuning in, my guest is a man who I have admired for many, many years, Professor James Tabor. He has written, he's published five books. He's made it to the top of the New York Times, the bestseller list. His latest title is called Restoring Abrahamic Faith, which is a direct challenge to Christians to consider the historic claims of the Jewish faith. His previous book, which I'm sure you've heard of because it was all over the place, including 2020 Nightline with the Ted Koppel, the whole thing, called The Jesus Dynasty, a new historical investigation of Jesus, His Royal Family, and the Birth of Christianity, was published by Simon Schuster. And by the way, I said this before, Roman Catholic Cardinal Egan, who, and you won't disagree with me, by Catholic terms, he's a liberal. He's not a fanatic. He got up and held up a copy of your book at St. Patrick's, which I think is the largest cathedral in the United States, and he said, and he told parishioners to boycott your book. And just to make this point, many people ask the question, why are there so many Israeli soldiers in the old city of Jerusalem. The reason we need so many Israeli soldiers in Jerusalem is to keep Christian priests from killing each other. That's right.
Well, that's one of the reasons, but I'm telling you, it boggles me to think that anybody would complain about the amazing way that the Israelis have stepped across the line and shook the hands of every group, including the Muslims at the Temple Mount. I mean, it's just, you know, who stops you from going up there? You know, basically, Israeli soldiers are there saying, you know, okay, it's closed, can't go. So, anyway, aren't we living in a bizarre time, I'm telling you.
It's so amazing.
But I'll tell you, you mentioned my book, The Jesus Dynasty. Here's what I think can change this, besides Israeli sovereignty over Jerusalem, which God hoped they keep forever, because I think it's the only fair, let's call it fair brokerage, that's the political term today. But what can really change things, I think, is if we can expose Christianity and all religions, really, to a proper historical investigation. And that means not to talk about theology in this abstract never-never-land kind of way, but to actually talk about reality. Like, if you want to talk about Jesus, here's where I got in trouble. Now, this should not be shocking, but I said it on national television. I was asked on 2020, why is your book so controversial? I said, because I suggested Jesus had a human father. Well, you know, everybody has a human father. And the rabbis say the Messiah will be a human being of the line of David, as in seed. I think that's male, right? And so, why is this controversial? Because people, the media and politics should not be into theology. And this Pope, actually, he's written a book on Jesus. He's read my book. I'm sure he doesn't care much for it. But I say this in a respectful way. What I say to my Christian readers is, look, I'll tell you two things about Jesus, and then after that we can discuss other things. He died, he's dead, and he's a human being. Now, I know that's offensive to Christian theology, but it's not offensive to historians. And if he's investigated as a human being in his own time and place, whether you end up liking him or hating him, you put him in the context of Judaism because there was no Christianity. And that's what a lot of Christians are discovering. They're discovering, with all this devotion they have to Jesus, that he didn't claim to be God. And he died thinking that somehow he would redeem Israel, which he didn't. And he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? So I investigate all of that in my book. And I think, believe it or not, a lot of Catholics have written me and they've been helped by this book. Because what they tell me is, you know, this is what we really think too, but it's not Jesus bashing to say that he was a real person, if he did exist, right? He was on the planet. And he lived and he died as we all do and as we all will. And that's the approach I take. And then I say, okay, leave the theology off the table. Christians care about how did he get here and how did he leave? Okay, forget how he got here and how he left. What was he when he was here? And I'm finding that there's room for dialogue because what they have to do, they have to learn what Passover is and what Shavuot is and Sukkot and what the Torah is, because these are the things, as a Jew, whether he was a good Jew or a bad Jew, let's leave that aside, he was in a Jewish world. He did not know about Easter, Christmas, the Lord's Supper. I mean, think about this. Jesus knew nothing of the Holy Communion. Some people say, well, he started the Holy Communion. Well, there's no historical evidence for that. So that's what I try to do in the Jesus Dynasty. And in the other book, I really take it, let's say, five steps further, Restoring Abrahamic Faith. I published it privately because you can get it at Genesis2000.org right now. That's the only place you can get it. Because I realize this book, it's one thing to publish an academic book, but this book, this is like a manifesto. I think you've got a copy, Tovia, but I don't know if you had time to read it yet. People are stunned when they read this book. I had a pastor order 60 copies, going to give them to his parishioners. I said, well, that hardly supports the faith you've taught them. And he says, well, whether they agree with all of it or not, they need to read this book, because there are things in here about the guy they claim to follow that they don't have a clue about. So this is not one of those messianic Jewish kind of, you know, Jesus was a Jew, he was just like us books. This is a hard-hitting book that basically questions whether Christianity is an Abrahamic faith. And I know it's very popular to say, well, of course it is. You know, Jews, Christians, Muslims are Abrahamic. But if you under, what Christians finally did is they said, look, Judaism is what? God, Torah, Israel, right? So Christians came along and they said, God, there's two or three. So there goes God. Torah, it's done away. Israel, you're not Israel, we're Israel. Now wait a minute. Those are the pillars of the faith. What if we went to a Muslim and we said the pillar is that there's no God but Allah, Muhammad's his prophet, and the Quran is his word. Now we're going to change that and say there are many gods, not Allah, Muhammad is a false prophet, and the Quran's not his word, but we want you to like us and still shake hands with us and say we're all Abrahamic. You think the Muslim would, oh, okay, but the Christians expect the Jews to say, you've undermined all three of our cardinal pillars of Judaism, but we're still with you, you know, we're all doing the same thing. And I'm not a rancorous person. I might sound like it because I'm getting worked up, but, you know, historical truth is historical truth. And I don't want to argue and condemn everybody. I just want people to be educated.
I need to ask you this question. We're going to go to the news break soon, and my guest is Professor James Tabor, new book out, Restoring Abrahamic Faith. I just want to ask you this one question, then we're going to go to the news break. Do you think that if the Christian Bible, meaning the Greek scriptures, 27 books, the way they're assembled is what's an Augustinian order, putting Matthew first, Revelations last, and Paul is just thrown around all the way in the middle. But if the Christian Bible, if the books were arranged in the chronological order in which they were written, meaning we'd have the letters of Paul first, so there'd be no mention of a virgin birth, we finally get to the book of Mark, which is the earliest chronologically in the Gospels. No virgin birth, none of this stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What impact would that have on Christians if they?
You want me to do it now or after your break?
All right, yeah, do it.
We got a minute.
Hey, you know what this is going to do? This is huge, so we're going to wait till after the news break.
It's a great question. I'm so glad you brought it up, and I will address it.
We're going to do that after the news break. I have to say this to you, James. Gosh, you know, in Judaism, we're not supposed to encourage people to convert to Judaism. We're not. We're supposed to, like, push them away three times.
Exactly. But
I'm on the radio, and I can do what I want. It's my show. Oh, man, if you and I were, like, walking past a mikvah, I'd, like, say, look over there, and then I'd sort of push you right in. Oh, my God.
You know what? I'll tell you, I've thought, people say, why don't you just convert and go join those people you love so much, Tabor? You know why? I'll tell you two reasons. First of all, I'm not Jewish, so I have the right to be a human being who believes in the God of Israel. If Israel's mission is to bring light to the nations, then it doesn't mean all the nations have to be Jews, and that's very clear within Jewish theology. Yeah. But the other reason, I could not publish the Jesus Dynasty. There's no way Simon & Schuster would have taken that book if on my bio it said, and this guy converted to Judaism.
Right.
Because they will not publish a book out of sensitivity to the Jews, really. For Jews to, I can say Jesus had a human father. His name was Pantera. He was a Roman soldier. You could say that if you're quoting a source. You could say according to a Tosefta, according to Celsus, right? But you, as a Jew, if you write a book on Jesus, a publisher, a New York publisher, would say, you know, Tovia, I'm afraid it'll bring on a wave of anti-Semitism.
Only
but as a non-Jew, I can do more for Israel outside than inside. I honestly believe that.
Let me just...
someday I'll come and join you.
I have to ask you this question. This is not a real question, but this is, like, very personal, James. Because your life has been studying Scripture. I'm not even asking you a question, but you have, you poured your life into studying sacred, the sacred works of the prophets. Your soul has to be itching a little bit, given that you know that we may be in a very special prophetic time, and there may not be a whole, I mean, we may be, you know, we may have front row seats now to the final redemption, so you've got to be, you've got to be itching a little bit. I'll just say, I say that to you out of, you know, I love you and respect you, and you're just a wonderful mind. You're a blessing. And when we come back after news break, I'm going to ask you about, because first century Christianity, we could...
Absolutely. We'll get into that.
We're
going to
get into that right here on Israel National Radio. If you're just tuning in, my guest is Professor. He's not a professor like at Queens College. He's at UNC. He's the chair. He's the head of the whole department, which means he knows what he's doing, and his PhD is from the University of Chicago. He didn't go to Grenada to get his PhD, and his latest book is out. It's called Restoring Abrahamic Faith. He's the author of the previous book called The Jesus Dynasty, which made Ted Koppel go a little nutty. And anyways, he's our guest right here on Israel National Radio. And we have, just tell me, my tech, how much time I have left. I think I have I have very little time, but here's just one little thing about this place on Mount Zion. Before 1967, that means before the Six-Day War, no Jew can go into the old city. No Jew can be where I am right now. And when Jews wanted to look at the Temple Mount, look into the old city, the place they would go was this place. They were able to go on the roof and then look into the old city and pray that a Jordanian soldier didn't shoot him in the head. So the key
Here's
this is for you, the listener. You have to start to wonder, as you're listening to this broadcast, you're listening to my guest, Dr. Tabor, Restoring Abrahamic Faith, you have to ask yourself, where are my roots? Where do I come from? That's the key question. Who am I? Do you know who you are? You listen to this singer, Israel National Radio. Wrap your brain around this concept. Who are you? Don't touch the dial. We are back. Singer here, Israel National Radio. My guest, Professor James Tabor. New book out, Restoring Abrahamic Faith. That's what we're doing right here on Israel National Radio. The pontiff is showing up in the Holy Land, and he wants to get paid. We're going to talk about the origins of Christendom with a man who ought to know. He's got a PhD in religion, and he's at the top of his field, James Tabor, right here. Don't touch the dial. Oh, man. Oh, wow. All right, we are back. Singer here, Israel National Radio. I want to give you my guest. His new book out is called Restoring Abrahamic Faith. This is a website. Write it down, Genesis2000.org. I'm going to say that again. It's just that simple. Genesis2000.org. Professor Tabor, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tovia. I was just thinking, the Pope's coming on Lod Va'Omer.
Yeah.
Isn't that something?
Oh, man.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, he's coming on
Lod Va'Omer. It just hit me when I heard the ad about counting the Omer, that it's on the 11th.
Yeah, he's coming. Yeah, he's coming on Monday.
Well.
And Monday night is Lod Va'Omer, where about 400,000 Jews are going. I mean, you don't understand. When you're talking about a country of 6 million people, 400,000 is an astounding number. By the way,
it's not just the Chapel Hill basketball team rally.
Let me just give my listeners in the listeners around the world. Let's just do this number. There are essentially, for every one Israeli, there are 60 Americans. Okay, now go ahead, take your shoes and socks off, and crunch the numbers. And then you'll figure out what that would mean in the United States. My guest, Professor James Tabor, new book out, Restoring Abrahamic Faith, is the author of five published books. Previous one is The Jesus Dynasty. Before we went to the new, first of all, my heart is broken that we're only on for two segments, because I could, and you know this, and my listeners know this, I'm not going to waste time, this is not hyperbole or saying that, I can have you on for 24 hours straight, and we wouldn't even get close to where I want to go with you. But before we went to news break, I asked you a question, and that is that the Christian Bible, the Greek Bible, has 27 books. but it is not organized in the chronological order in which they were written. Incidentally, what I've just said is not an issue of debate. All Christians, evangelical conservatives to liberal guys,
Absolutely agree. Everybody
understands that Mark is the earliest of the four Gospels, and Paul is written way before them. And my question to you is, the order of the Christian Bible is not an accident. If the Christian Bible had been written in the chronological order that it was authored, what impact would that have on Christians who start at the beginning and go to the end?
It would have a tremendous impact. And I'll tell you, there is one Bible. Unfortunately, it's hard to find. So remember Hugh Schoenfield, who wrote the Passover plot? He published the authentic New Testament. It's worth buying in a used bookstore if you can get it. And he has the book starting with 1 Thessalonians, which is Paul's earliest letter. As you said, you get a completely different impression because Christianity develops. And actually, when you start even with Paul, you're skipping what I call the dark ages of 20 years. Jesus died in 30, Paul wrote in 50. There's 20 years when they weren't believing anything close to what Christians came to believe. And then Paul begins some of the teachings, and then it begins to accelerate. And you're right, by the time Mark has no virgin birth, Mark has no resurrection appearances. This shocks people because they have versions of Mark that have been edited later, like in the King James. But all the scholars agree that Mark originally ends, Jesus doesn't even appear like in the movies, you know, glowing in front of the cave. And then you get to Matthew is next, and then Luke, and by the time you get to John, Thomas is calling him my Lord and my God. So you could just see this development, and it would make a great difference. I'll tell you what I'm going to do about this. I've got a new book contract with Simon & Schuster, same publisher, best publisher in the world in my opinion. And it's on Paul. I'm writing a book on Paul. Nobody's ever written a readable book on Paul. Paul is so dense, so theological, to some people inaccessible, to others boring. And I'm going to write a, I don't want to call it racy, but zippy, maybe racy, treatment of Paul. And the argument I'm going to make is exactly that there's a missing, I don't even want to call it Christianity because it wasn't Christianity, but the followers of Jesus before Paul, led by James, the brother of Jesus, were not even remotely Christian, and they went on for decades until the destruction of the temple in 70, and they lived on Mount Zion. That's where they were, up there. That's why the tradition of the Last Supper is up there. It has nothing to do with eating the body and blood of a god, which is about the most pagan notion that anybody could come up with. In fact, we've got texts. I don't know if you've heard of the Didache. It was discovered in the 1880s in a monastery. It has a Last Supper scene, and instead of Jesus saying, eat my body and drink my blood, which no Jew would ever say, you know, to drink blood even symbolically is reprehensible, He gives the regular Jewish blessing over the bread and wine in this text called the Didache. So in my book, I'm going to put all that back in the proper order. There's a sense in which I'm doing in my book what you suggest that we do it with the order of the New Testament. And it makes a tremendous difference. Christians think that Jesus came first and then Paul. Paul came first, and then Jesus got morphed into this God-man, Savior, heavenly being who barely touches earth and goes back to heaven and saves humans. It has nothing to do with the historical Jesus, as far as I'm concerned.
I'll make a statement, and you give me your thoughts. Rome did not convert to Christianity. Christianity converted to Rome.
I would absolutely agree with that. And if you go, I think it's earlier than most people put it. Most people want to go to Constantine and rag on Constantine, and he certainly has lots of reprehensible qualities that we could criticize. But frankly, I think the mystery of iniquity, to use a New Testament phrase out of context, was already at work as early 20, 30 years after the death of Jesus. People are already beginning to adapt mystery religion, Greco-Roman kind of concepts, Greek dualism, and they're losing the Judaic heritage. Now, in Jerusalem, I think it stayed solid. Josephus mentions James, the brother of Jesus. He said that he was so revered that when he died, many of the Jews who were the devout Jews felt that God would, you know, punish the wicked ones for killing him and so forth. I don't think these people were apostatizing, but it's out in the Gentile world, in the Roman world. They are simply turning this into a very popular form of a Greek mystery religion, and I think everybody knows that. You offer salvation through the blood of your Savior who's risen from the dead and gone to heaven. And people say, well, that's Christian. It's not Christian. It's Christian as Christianity became, but it's basically a late development. And the reason we don't know about the original followers, James and his brothers and so forth, is because they're written out of the story. They're completely muted. And their story is not even told. I think you get a little bit, you know, the New Testament book of James. If you take out two words out of that book, it's a good Jewish book. Two times he refers to the faith of Jesus Christ. I think it's an interpolation. Just try an experiment. Go to James in the New Testament. Open it up, and when you and just take out those two words and read it, and you'll think you're reading like Pirkei Avot or something. It's just good Jewish ethics and morals and, you know, prayer, fasting, and so forth. That's all it is.
And that's why Luther couldn't stand
it. Oh, he couldn't stand it.
He called it a straw of a gospel.
And yeah, he said an epistle of straw. Yeah.
A straw,
yeah.
Right. And
he put it in the back. You talk about changing the order. Did you know the Luther Bible? The original Luther Bible took James out. It's already at the back.
Right.
And he took it out entirely and put it in appendix in small print. This is hilarious to me.
Yeah.
But you talk about symbolism. Here's a guy saying the most important thing is Paul and James is least. And I think what you and I would be saying, you know, if you really want to know what was going on early, you probably ought to look at James. And he puts this in the back. So
right.
There you go.
So in essence, Luther didn't like James 2:24-26. That's
clear. Oh, like the law is eternal and the Torah will never pass away.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it works. But let me ask you this question, because, you know, people say the Trinity was invented in 325 at the Council of Nicaea. Of course, that's nonsense. The idea of the Trinity is already developing 2nd, 3rd century, no question. But these movements where you have Christianity in North Africa and Egypt, as opposed to Syria and Asia Minor, there's great schisms and fights, and there are other gospels, other books that some communities... It is Constantine who ultimately, his mother is going to point out where all these so-called holy sites are. It is Constantine who's going to lay the law down at the Council of Nicaea of what is orthodoxy and what is heresy. Am I right?
Absolutely.
He organizes the whole deal.
And the other thing is, the council, everybody knows the creed, but I'll tell you what's interesting to read in the council, and you have to go to a library and get the actual records of the Council of Nicaea, but they're in print in English. And what you want to read are the decrees at the end of the council, not just the creed. The creed is just window dressing. Curses on Jews, curses on Christians who keep the Sabbath. Well, why would you curse a Christian for keeping the Sabbath unless Christians are still thinking, well, maybe we should keep the Sabbath? There are about 200 of these decrees that were also passed by the British. It's like the amendments of the, it's like the pork bill legislation. The bill passes, but you didn't know all this other stuff was attached. Well, Nicaea passed, but all this other stuff is attached. And it's the most vile stuff against Judaism. And it gets worse. In later councils, if a Christian even talks to a Jew, a Christian cannot visit a synagogue, a Christian cannot talk to a rabbi. Now, this is simply fear, Tovia. You know, you've made your career by, I guess we could call, discussing, debating openly issues between Jews and Christians. And there doesn't have to be any fear. Two groups can come together, lay the material on the table, and just say, do these texts or do these texts not say what a certain person is claiming. and you can talk about it. What these councils are doing, they're not trying to open any dialogue. They're trying to say, don't even go near this. My book would have been so banned, I wouldn't even exist right now.
You'd be gone.
For 5 minutes, because if you read, I want Jews to read this book, not just Christians. First, they'll learn a little bit about their own faith. But secondly, if you have a Jewish, if you're a Jew and you have a Christian friend that you think might be wondering a little bit, this is the perfect book, because it won't offend them, but it will really, you know, open up their thinking, and then you can have a good discussion instead of an argument.
Yeah,
you and I should go on the road together, Tovia.
We should, let's do it right now. Let's do it.
No, we should do it. We should do a national tour in which we, you know, meet with various people that want to discuss issues and do it live.
Yeah, but if you had written anything remotely like this, going back centuries ago, you would have the same fate as folks
Absolutely.
Like John Rogers and William Tyndale, who were just translating the Bible. they didn't even write it. All they were doing is translating the Vulgate into English so people could understand it.
But here's the viciousness is that not only were they killed later, like their bodies are dug up and burnt, even after, you know, it's just the viciousness of it.
It's unmatched for translating the Bible into a language that simply people can understand.
You know why? Because if you start really reading it, even the Greek New Testament, and you read it, like you said, in chronological order, it will raise more questions than it will answer. You won't come away saying, oh, thank God, now I know my faith is true. You'll come away asking your preacher, wait, Mark doesn't have any resurrection appearance. Why is there no virgin birth? Why does Paul never mention the virgin birth? Why does Paul say that Jesus is of the seed of David? The seed of David? What is David now? Is God now a descendant of David? You know, if you think God is Jesus' father, you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
So people, I'm telling you, translating the Bible clearly is a very dangerous thing.
Yeah.
Even the New Testament.
And I'll say one last thing, and then we're going to run out of time. Oh, Lord. It's not only what isn't in the Christian Bible, it's also what was interpolated later. I'm talking about 1 John 5:7, that literally the church would then go back into the Christian Bible and simply shove verses in there which weren't there in the earlier text in order to take the doctrines that were developed later and insert them into the text. I can't even go there. I'm not going to go into.
You know Bart Ehrman's book, Misquoting Jesus. Everybody should read that. I mean, that book is so fascinating to show. People say, well, I follow the Bible. And the question should be, let's just say the New Testament. I read the New Testament. I think it's the Word of God. The question should be, which New Testament are you referring to?
Right. And when we say, I just want the listeners to understand, so many listeners are not familiar with this, when we say that there are differences, it's not like we're talking about there's a one-letter difference. We're talking about whole sections of chapters, talking about the whole end of the book of Mark after verse 9. Everybody knows that's an interpolation. James, just we have a few minutes left, my guest. I want to bang this into my listener's head. Write this down, Genesis2000.org. That's where you can, the blogs, where you can get the book, Restoring the Abrahamic Faith, and study about my guest, Professor James Tabor, who I not just love his mind, I love his heart, and I know listeners around the world are saying the same thing. I have the opportunity to speak to him, and we have 4 minutes left, and this is a real tragedy, and I feel like just canceling the commercials and the news because we have to pay the bills.
We'll have another time.
Let's get back real soon and do this. I just want to ask you about one thing that we sort of slipped over because we got so involved in this. This should have been a two-hour show. Major mistake. Question. The Jesus tomb in Talpiot.
I'll give you a short answer. Short answer, my blog, Genesis2000.org, is just the book. The blog is jamestabor.com, just as easy. T-A-B-O-R. That has an archive, the Tabor blog, of all my discussion of the Jesus tomb. So you can read all night, and it's the best place to go. But the long answer in the next minute or two that we have. So go and read and study that. But the long answer, your friend and my friend, Semka Jakubovici, and I, you know, we worked together on this for 5 years. We do believe, I do believe, as a scholar, that, and I'm saying this as an academic, that this site, this grave site, has a likelihood of being the final burial spot of Jesus of Nazareth. I'm speaking just historically, that it's his family burial plot. Now, what that means theologically to some people who think his bones actually went to heaven is one thing, but all Christians don't believe that. Some Christians see the resurrection as kind of a spiritual thing, you know, like shedding the skin and leaving behind, and then the soul, like remember the movie Cocoon, where the earthly body falls away and the heavenly body comes up. But we don't discuss that. All we discuss is, here's the tomb, here are the names, here are the facts. Now, what we knew evangelical Christians would go crazy over this. No question about that.
Right.
Because many of them do believe that the body of Jesus went to heaven. That literally, we're talking organs, liver. I'm not trying to be funny here, but think about it. The body of Jesus went to heaven. Now, also, though, the Israelis were upset at us. Our colleagues were upset at us. Because they said, we had speculated, we jumped the gun, but I'll tell you what's really behind it. The last thing Israel really wants to be in custody of, or probably should be in custody of, and I agree with this, is the real tomb of Jesus. Let the Christians go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Let them go to the Garden Tomb. It's empty. This tomb might be the real thing. But it's a problem for Israel, because what would you do if it were ever proven that it was? I would say the verdict is out, but it's not going to remain out. I think in our lifetime, there's enough going on right now that we have in mind to definitively decide this one way or the other. But the arguments are, you can look at the blog, I probably have 100 posts on the Jesus family tomb. So short answer is, don't dismiss it, but the verdict is still out.
And a key point here, Professor, is that the tomb, which you and other scholars believe is the tomb of Jesus, the critical part is not just a Jesus thing, is we're talking about a whole family.
A whole family.
That's the critical part. That's what
and see, if people don't know, when Jesus was buried, he was hastily put in a temporary tomb near the site of the crucifixion. So if you ask, I was talking to an Israeli, I won't give you his name, but he said, I don't think that's right. I think Jesus is in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And I said, well, Professor, wish I could say his name, but I won't, because I said, is he still there? You're a Jew. Is he still there? He goes, no. And you don't think he was raised? No, of course not. I'm a Jew. So he's not there, and he wasn't raised. Do you think he was put in another tomb?
Hmm.
He goes, I see your point. So, in other words, the idea of a secondary burial is well known in Judaism.
Right, right.
You know, the permanent burial.
And just as a point, just for folks who don't know this, I mean, there's a very few serious Christian scholars think that the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is the burial place. Everyone understands that Helena is the one who did it. The story is like woven to what happened and how she figured it out and what was the real cause. We can't go there because we're going into the Sabbath, the true Sabbath, which is the seventh day. It's not the first day. It's not the sixth day. It's the seventh day. And Professor Tabor, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Well, Shabbat Shalom to you. And let's get together again soon.
I look forward to that. And to all my listeners, I wish you all a Shabbat Shalom, and may we merit to see, witness, and experience the true final Shabbat quickly in our times. James, thank you for joining us here. Genesis.
Thank you, Tavia.
Thank you, brother. Genesis2000.org is the website. Write it down, and to all of you, a Shabbat Shalom.
Concludes the interview. Thank you for listening. Until next week, just remember that James's website and book are available at Genesis 2000.org. God bless.